if I have any deep message that anyone who turns into Nerd Appropriate looking for a deep message.
So many people do.
Yeah.
Deep Thoughts by Patrick Lewis.
Life in open drugs. And also...
Rated NA number 75, a very special episode for the website nerdappropriate.com. We have an interview today, folks.
Yeah. Heyo.
And it's a good one.
It is a good one. We are talking to Patrick Weeks, who recently put a book out called The Palace Job and also is a writer at BioWare. So, what's up, guys?
Not much. I'm excited to have everyone listen to this Patrick Weeks conversation because he's a pretty fun dude. So I think there's a lot of laughs and there's a lot of great content in there, and actually a lot of information for aspiring writers as well. So if you like fiction at all, you like fantasy, I think he has a lot of great stuff to say about it. So, but other than that, everything's been going well. I mean, we just recorded a couple days ago, and I know we picked up Borderlands. I think most of us
probably need to talk about that next week on 76. Yes.
So next week we'll have our big Borderlands blowout, but I've been playing a bit of that, and I'm playing as Axton, the commando, who is pretty awesome. And just working and writing and hanging out, and I ate Jimmy John's in my face.
Doing the thing, man. You're just doing the thing.
Yeah.
Fantastic. How about you, Scott?
I played a copious amount of Borderlands as well, and it is quite excellent. And I'm stoked on it. I'm like totally into it. We played multiplayer for like 5 minutes.
Yeah,
and it's awesome.
Drop in and drop out works well, because I literally just jumped into Scott's game and shot stuff for 10 minutes and then jumped out. So it works so well.
And I crushed a helicopter with my whatever ability. That was, and it was locked. Awesome. Yes, I phase locked a helicopter and it was awesome. So that's what I've been doing for the past 3 days.
I finally got my sniper rifle, because I'm playing Zero.
Nice. Yeah.
I've already unlocked all the headshot stuff. Like,
oh my God, you're so
I
good
haven't
at
even
that.
Advanced. I just started like going. I was like critting left and right. God, I love this game so much, but we'll talk about it next week. And other than that, for me, I've been reading Patrick's book, actually. So
fantastic.
Those are the two things I've really been up to. How about you, Hillary?
I haven't gotten Borderlands 2 yet, so bad on me. But I have been watching, I think I mentioned it last podcast, but I've been watching a lot of Battlestar Galactica, just trying to catch up. And I just finished it, and my mind was blown. So big recommendation out there. If you want to watch something that's awesome and well-told, and just awesome, really cool sci-fi.
It's not too late.
I feel like it's a holiday break like show for me. Like I need to be able to commit time to it,
It's long.
It's a great
show. Each episode's like 40 minutes or so, and then there's like 80 episodes.
Oh,
so.
Let me
ask
so
you
good.
This. I'm going to do a little psychological experiment on you, Hillary.
When
you think of Starbuck, Katie Sackhoff,
my favorite.
What tool for cutting do you think of? First one that comes to your mind.
X-Acto blade?
Oh, okay, never mind. You didn't go where
she eats with like a
you'll get this joke
no,
later.
Let it go.
You'll
oh
get
my
this joke
god,
later.
Just let it
go. You are not saying scissor.
Wow.
You're just such an idiot.
Oh my god.
Oh no. Okay. I meant that in the nicest possible way.
It's okay.
So with that, let us take you to the interview with Patrick Weeks. As Ash said before, it's awesome. And if you are an aspiring writer, there is a ton of information in there about getting started and where to find your voice or how to find your voice and all that kind of stuff. So,
and there might actually be some stuff you haven't heard about the creation of Mass Effect. So if you're a Mass Effect fan, hang in there and listen for some secrets.
Secrets.
Then, if you stick around till the end, we have two contests we're going to be running to go along with this podcast. So stick around and we will tell you more after the interview.
All All right, we are here, episode 75 of the Rated NA podcast, with our very special guest, Patrick Weeks, author of The Palace Job and also author over at BioWare. You may know him from writing for the Mass Effect series. We love him and we're glad he's here. And so we're here with Scott, Matt, Hillary, and myself, Ash, and we're going to have a nice long chat with Mr. Weeks.
Yay!
Woo-hoo, hey, 75!
How you doing?
Yeah, congrats on 75. That's fantastic.
Thanks. We never thought we'd make it this far.
It's because of me. Just say it.
We do talk about that all the time on the podcast, that like we'll get to like, you know, every landmark, like episode 60. We're like, how do we make it this far? And then we just kind of, you know, we're like a really damaged marathon runner at this point. So we just
limping to the next hit of Gatorade.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Or tequila in my case.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, Hillary podcasts drunk all the time. It's kind of embarrassing.
That is not true.
Well, I don't know, Hillary. I heard 69 and 70, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
I was like, where are you going with that?
There's some cold medicine involved there, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah, we're already talking about 69. This is going to be a good episode.
Oh, no. Do you know, actually, Scott is keeping like a file with all of our screw-ups and funny things, and he's going to whip that out one day and shock the world on how
Yeah, every time I've seen... to have a blooper reel. I think that's fantastic. That's how you know you've made it, when you've got the blooper reel.
Scott, I think the challenge has been raised. I think you need to
this
blooper episode.
I want to do like a fake clips episode, so maybe we'll integrate those somehow.
Oh, yeah.
So let's go ahead and dive in, because we have a giant cornucopia of questions to ask you here.
Yes.
And the first one for Patrick was, we want to know your origin story, because Karen told me a little bit about how you guys started at BioWare just in conversation, and I thought the story was hilarious, and so I wanted to...
She did?
Well, a little. Wow. I know it had to do with talking weapons, so I wanted...
She's such a giver.
Yes, she tells me all the secrets, but yeah, we want to hear your story, and you know, and it might inspire some people to. Oh, hold on, that's my dog being a dog.
So for those people out there, Karen is Patrick's wife, and also she is a senior editor at BioWare as well.
And also my manager. So, like, the reason, like, she's kind of like Colonel Karen. She needs like the aviator glasses, like that. Because, like, the reason I am actually Skyping with you guys is because Karen hooked up the machine and did the stuff. So I have reached the point where I'm like, Skype? Yeah, I have people for that. You know,
amazing.
Who set that stuff up and make sure I have pants and remind me when I forget to take the garbage out.
Thing is, it's Skype. You don't need pants.
True.
It's the glory of Skype.
True.
This is it like the Mass Effect game night? Is it like the setup for the Mass Effect game night?
Oh yeah,
that was amazing. By the way, that setup was pure.
Oh
amazing.
Yes, our rockin' bed style. That was awesome.
Yeah. Yes,
living the AAA game development lifestyle with a
TV on the bed.
So tell us how you got started at BioWare, and you know, maybe even if you want to go further back and kind of explain what you were like as a kid. We love to hear about that stuff,
sure.
Because those are fun.
So I always, on some level, wanted to be a writer, and it took me a while to actually kind of contextualize that as a thing I could do, as opposed to a thing I had to jump through other hoops in order to be able to do. I think when I was maybe 10 years old, we got our first computer. It was an IBM PC Junior. And then I saw that my friend Arthur had a sweet, rocking IBM PC.
Nice.
And that, yeah, we were playing Telengard. We were living large. And his PC had a thing on it that let him write stories. He called it a word processor, and I was confused. and I was like, well, I want one of those on mine. And I didn't have... any money, and I didn't actually, okay, that's not true. I probably did have money if I thought about it, but it never occurred to me that a word processor was something you could buy. So I wrote one in BASIC.
Oh, wow.
So that I could write my stories.
That's incredible.
Yes, awesome. and let's all thank God those stories are lost to time.
No.
Yes, the story of the rogue and his talking magical sword, which apparently is a theme for me because that is what comes back later.
Awesome.
Yeah.
You don't have a 5 1/4 floppy laying around somewhere with all those?
No, it caught fire, oddly.
Really?
What?
So jeez. Sad. So sad. It was, you know, you pour some gasoline on there, light a few matches, and darn, just go right up. But yes, the sad story of the incredibly witty banter between the rogue and his magical talking sword, you know, as written by a 10-year-old. And then later the fighter who is secretly revealed to be half golden dragon.
So you had an interest in fantasy since you were a little kid, since you were very young.
Yes, I did. I had no time for reality.
What was your first exposure to that?
You know, it's funny because I was into mysteries and stuff, the Hardy Boy books, and my mom kept trying to get me into fantasy because she knew there were more books, because I'd kind of read all the Hardy Boy books, and I could pretty much blow through a Hardy Boy book in about an hour and a half there at the end. And she finally got me, she was like, do you want to read these Robert Aspirin books? They've got puns. And no. and she finally brought me over to David Eddings. So David Eddings was my gateway drug. The Belgariad was my gateway drug to fantasy.
Oh, nice.
And then from there, I just kind of, you know, blurped out and read everything.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so when I got to, you know, when I got to school, when I went to university, I had the brilliant plan that, again, I was like, okay, so what I really love doing is writing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go pre-med. I'm going to become a doctor. I'm going to make enough money to retire or cut back to part-time, and then I'll do writing.
And, solid plan.
Yeah, I know, right? And then, fortunately, I was saved by organic chemistry.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's hard.
Not an easy class.
Which I took, got a not great grade in, retook, because the school I was at, you could retake and have the new grade replace the old grade.
Oh, nice.
And got the same grade.
Oh.
I was like, no, you really, really did deserve that. And I was like, all right.
This is not for you.
Yeah. So, yes, then I don't know, maybe I could try this writing thing. From there, I pretty much just moved into doing whatever kind of writing I could find as a day job and writing on my own at night. You know, sci-fi, fantasy, kind of whatever I was feeling like. I don't know if Karen mentioned this to you, Ash, but I went through an interesting phase when I was writing a lot of very, like, dark, grim, literary stuff because I had a few friends who were like, you know, they would read and they'd crit the stuff. And you know how it is when you're around your friends. Like, your friends are the group that you interact with. They're your social group. And if they're, you know, if you're not seeing your stuff pop up online, you know, if you're not seeing it, any feedback except from these people, then, you know, they're incredibly important to you. And for a while I was writing this very, you know, dark adult literary stuff, and it wasn't selling. I was sending it out, and I called it Rejection Litter Bingo. I had an Excel spreadsheet.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my goodness.
All the of the fantasy and sci-fi magazines as the rows, and then the columns were the name of the stories. And it was great. And I had, like, okay, I have it pre-X'd out if it's not a good fit. Like, you know, I'm not going to send spaceships to realms of fantasy. That doesn't work. And you know, here's when I sent it, and here's when I got the rejection. Here's what, okay, good. So what? And, you know, it took some doing to kind of get to a point. And I would love to say that there was some awesome breakthrough, but honestly, it was just waking up one day and realizing I was writing stuff that I wouldn't actually want to read.
Yeah.
Mm.
So, yeah.
That's important.
So, like, if I have any deep message that anyone who turns into Nerd Appropriate looking for a deep message.
So many people do.
Yeah.
Deep Thoughts by Patrick Weeks.
Yes. Don't do drugs. And also, write what you'd want to read.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, like, don't write to try to impress people you don't really like. Don't write because it's what you feel you ought to write. I mean, I have a degree in English, and so there are times when I'm like, I should really, you know, Karen calls it Patrick had just read Ulysses phase. through and I was writing stuff. We're like, look, in this scene, I didn't use the letter O. And that's meaningful. And I was like, yeah, is the story any good? Nope. But I didn't use the letter O. And so eventually it just got to a point where I was like, okay, you know, I get home from a long day at work writing copywriting marketing text for high-end availability back office banking systems.
That's a mouthful. Wow.
Yeah. And
I don't even understand what that is.
Yeah. Which makes it hard to write context for, but
yeah.
Yeah. And you've got, you know, I didn't have kids yet, but you know, these days I got two kids. I have a job that keeps me busy and it's like, you got to feed the kids, you know, spend time with your loved ones, get the kids to bed, deal with the pets and the chores and everything. And then maybe you have a little time to do something you enjoy, mm-hmm. you know, be it, you know, watch something or read something or play something. Mm-hmm. And if you're a writer, write the thing that you would want to do in that period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really good advice.
So when you were starting off, as you said that you had a group of friends that you were, you know, kind of bouncing ideas around, did you ever actually go to like a writer's group or anything? I mean, I know now you probably have a lot of great people to, you know, talk to about critiques and stuff like that at BioWare, but before, did you have friends that were writerly?
Yeah, actually, that was a writing group.
Oh, okay, cool.
And actually, and to be fair, that makes it sound like they were the people who misled me, and you know, it was a horrible. Like they're really good writers. It's mm-hmm. just we're very different writers, and mm-hmm. You know, when you're a new writer and you're trying to find your voice, the people around you are very influential, and so what I did was I had them. And I had a couple people at school, you know, friends that I've met that I met at university. And so I was just kind of bouncing stuff around there. And I started writing stuff that I wanted to read. Funnier stuff, stuff that, you know, didn't have a lot of pretense to be big and deep and meaningful. And was just like, nope, I'm just having fun. And if something meaningful pops up, that's a happy coincidence.
Totally. Okay.
And that's when it started selling.
Oh, nice.
Which was, you know, kind of interesting. And it happened fast enough that it's like, I can't directly say yes. The moment that it's like, wow, really? The moment I started writing the happy stuff, that's when it started selling. And like, all right, well, you know, maybe the universe was trying to tell me something.
Sorry. I just want to ask. So you mentioned your voice, and that's actually something a lot of people ask. I think that's kind of common in any art form. I mean, be it, you know, drawing or writing or whatever. So, I mean, how did you know that you discovered your voice? And also, do you have any advice to people who are trying to, you know, maybe trying too hard in defining their own voice or style?
Well, I think it's both easier and harder today because you have mm-hmm. so much social media and so much easy, fast interaction. And sometimes it seems like for me, one of the things that it took to find my voice is you have to, again, you have to write what you want to read, but one of my writing teachers just called it the million words of crap. You have to write about a million words of crap before you're a real writer, and you know you're like, yep, that sure was a novel that I wrote after after I'd read Ulysses, and that wasn't very good, and I was obviously desperately in need of a girlfriend, as the course of the book. But it, you know, it just takes enough time and, you know, and try different styles. For me, one of the jokes that I you know, would tell about myself for a while and you know, still do to a certain extent is I don't write. I can't actually write. I can just impersonate people who can.
A lot of singers say that too.
Yeah. I'm a pretty good mimic. So, you know, one of the, trying to write a scene and going, okay, I'm going to write this scene like it's in one of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time. Okay, now I'm going to rewrite. Now I'm going to do a scene like I'm George R. R. Martin. Now I'm going to do a scene like I'm Guy Gabriel Kaye. Now I'm going to do a scene like I'm Terry Pratchett. And, you know, obviously what happens for a while is if you do nothing but that, you can eventually just become the guy who is not as good as Terry Pratchett, because all you ever know is that you're trying to be Terry Pratchett so hard that you're forgetting to be you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if you try it and you make mistakes and you see what works and what you like, oh, I like that line. That felt good. Okay. I'm going to go try something else now. And eventually you figure out for like, yeah, you figure out who you are. And I think the other part of it that, for me at least, I think it's important is you is not a constant value. Like, even after I would, you know, I'd say that I found my voice, but me 5 years from now is probably going to be writing in a different style. And I mean, and I hope that's still fun to the people who are reading my stuff or playing my stuff. I hope they don't look at that and go like, oh my God, Patrick Weeks has gone totally around the bend. But because that would be really insulting. And unfortunately, that would fit on a tweet. So they could totally say that to me.
There you go.
But, you know, but I think if you get something like there is no goal, there is no, oh, great, now I get to stop growing as a person because I have found it and made it and succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
But you had asked me about talking magical swords.
Oh, yeah. So the original question was actually getting hired at BioWare. We heard it had something to do with a short story you wrote about a talking magical sword.
And to be fair, there is a question I want to ask later about a talking weapon. So.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Yep.
Yay.
Like I said, apparently that's a theme for me. So the writing started to happen a little bit more. Stuff started to sell. And I went to a writing workshop called Clarion West. And I don't know if any of you guys have heard of it. It's a writing workshop for science fiction and fantasy writers mainly, generally focusing on short fiction, and it is awesome.
Oh, cool. I have not heard of it.
I totally want to go.
As a writer, you know, I grew up feeling like the stereotypical person who doesn't have anybody really like him at school.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of us feel that way.
Yeah, I think most people do, but mine was special, Ash. And you know, and I always said like eyes on the prize. I'll get to university, and then everyone will be like me. And I got to university, and that was totally not true. like, oh wow, well, I'm still the weird guy who wants to write about, you know, talking magical swords and crap. And you know, for me, the time when I finally hit the first group of people where I went into a room and I was like, I have found my people. I have found my geeky, wonderful, get my jokes, make jokes that catch me off guard people, was when I went to Clarion West and was, you know, and met my writing buddies.
Nice. So do you think like that inspiration kind of drove you to like, to want to perform? You think your writing group was kind of like a cattle prod or a whip to
absolutely.
Be better?
Oh, absolutely.
A cattle prod.
I'm thinking something drastic. It was the first thing that popped into my mind. Cattle prod.
Yeah. I mean, so Clarion West kind of got things started. I got back from Clarion West and, you know, kept in good touch with them and, you know, with many of the people there. And they, you know, that essentially gives me, they're a great group. I can always send stuff out to, you know, some of the people I've kept in touch with and get a good critique from people who, you know, they respect me. They're not trying to make me like them. They challenge me. And, you know, until I came to BioWare, That was, like I said, that was the first time I really found a group that I was like, oh, these are my people.
Cool.
And then I was fortunate enough, you know, to land at BioWare and find another group like that, which happened because I was talking with one of my Clarion West alumni buddies, and work was bad at the time. work was not good. I had left the banking system copywriting job, because the economy was not so hot. It's great now, though. You know, enjoy yourself.
Sure.
And I was dealing with issues of American socialization and manhood by. I was tutoring high school students for the SAT.
Oh boy!
While Karen pretty much supported the family, working at her job.
Ouch.
As kind of a white bread dude, that was a tough time to go through. But I was trying to, you know, and also. Tutoring the kids and stuff, it was really, really interesting because you run into sometimes where you're like, oh my God, I am Jaime Escalante and stand and deliver. I have touched this child's life and I I have put them on the road to success, and that is awesome. And I have made a difference, and I am one of the 1,000 points of light. And then other times, you're like, well, this certainly was a kid whose parents thought they could pay for their child to get a higher SAT score.
Yeah, you're totally preaching to the choir because
that's right. Because
I know exactly how you feel. Yeah. Those moments are so rare though, where you're like, I'm actually making a difference in the world.
Yeah.
Most of the time, you just feel like you're getting kicked and abused. But
like, really, yes. I'm sorry. Do you know how much your parents are paying for this? You really do have to do the homework.
Yeah. Those aren't cheap. Yeah.
So anyway, I came out of one of those, and I think as a defense mechanism, I got really, really creative with the writing. Because when you're dealing with entitled high school student number 70, you just start looking for ways to cope, I think. And so I sort of was like, okay, so what does this tell me about interpersonal communication? And how can I use this in a story somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking with my buddies, and I said, you know, it'd be interesting. I've got a lot of, you know, I've seen stories where the hero is the hero, and the magical talking weapon is pretty much just there to tell the hero he's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much of the slightly older stuff you guys read, but like David Eddings, the Orb of Alder, it's not really there to challenge Belgarion. It's just pretty much there to go like, dude, you rock, go save the world, and like. And he goes, yeah, am I really? Because he's humble. And then the orb goes like, dude, you totally are. And then he does. You got that.
Amazing.
Yeah, you rock, dude. And then you have like the obvious counter to that, which is, you know, the human is kind of a loser, and the sword or, you know, whatever the talking magical device is actually the brains of the operation, or it's overbearing, or, you know, whatever it is. And I'd seen both of those a bunch. And I said, you know, I think those have kind of been done to death. But what if there were something different? Like, what if you had a story where the guy and his talking magical sword had a different relationship? Like, what if or girl, yes. Could you do something like that where it's like, you know, if they had the relationship that you have with the person you share an office cubicle with, or you share an office, you know, you're in the next cubicle over, and it's like you get along, you're working on the same thing, but also you wish they wouldn't do that thing with the post-it notes and the stapler. And my writing buddy said, really, Patrick? Like, I kind of think those have been done to death, and I don't really see that selling. Which is sort of a red flag for me. That's just a cape, waving the red cape, whatever the Matador reference is. Assume I just made it and it was really witty. We're fixing all this.
Exactly.
We can add laugh tracks where appropriate.
That'd be awesome.
Totally add laugh tracks.
Oh my god, please.
Nerd Appropriate is filmed in front of a live studio audience. So the next day, I wrote a story about a talking magical sword. Whose entire point, the entire point of the story was to get to the hero trying to take a woman back to his room at the tavern and finding that the talking magical sword had already gotten someone up there herself, that he was sexiled from his own tavern room by his talking magical sword. That was the big purpose of the story. And I wrote
it
in an
afternoon. Sounds hilarious, actually.
It's a fun. I had fun with it, and I wrote it, and I sold, and I didn't like. I maybe spell checked it, but like there are stories that I like. I'm gonna work on this so hard. I'm gonna send it through multiple drafts and really evoke the core feelings. And then there's like, yeah, this took me about 2 hours to write. I maybe spell checked it. I sent it in, and I sent it to Amazing Stories, the guy at Amazing Stories. He emailed me and said, I don't email people, but I love this story so much that I had to let you know before you got the letter that I've accepted it, and also have you thought of doing a sequel? And I, who had in no way thought of doing a sequel, said, of course, when would you like the sequel? And wrote another one, and he said you know, bought that one immediately as well, and said, how would you like this to be syndicated, where you could just keep doing these? And I, who had nothing in mind beyond the second story, said, absolutely, I would love to be syndicated. Let's do this thing. I have a wealth of stories in mind for this. And then the next thing that happened was that he left Amazing Stories magazine to go write for BioWare.
Oh, wow. This is all working out quite well.
Yeah.
In your favor.
Yeah. So anyway, I wrote him, you know, a nice note going, you know, hey, congratulations, you know, because BioWare was my dream company. I was like, there are only a few games, there are only a few companies whose titles I will buy without looking at all at what they were, you know, at what game it was. It was like, it's by BioWare, whatever. And, you know, BioWare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I say, hey, congratulations. That's fantastic. You know, I love that company. Let me know if you need any, if BioWare needs any stories about talking magical swords. And he said, well, do you want to apply?
Uh-oh.
And Karen was 6 months pregnant at the time. So this was Karen 6 months pregnant and me not really having a job. Yeah. Living in California. I kind of said, you know, I really appreciate you. It's a really nice offer, but, you know, I'm preparing to kind of be a stay-at-home dad. We don't want to, you know, it's probably not the best time, but thanks. I really appreciate that. And then mentioned it to Karen, who kind of maybe smacked me.
To be fair, though, a lot of people would have said that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a
well, yeah. Huge... I mean, that's the thing. I had lost, you know, I didn't have a good job. I was dealing with the fact that I was being completely supported by my wife, which that sounds really old fashioned, but I think for a lot of guys, that's a really tough thing.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's, you know, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's something that we grow up learning about, gender roles and, you know, the man's supposed to do this.
I know. I'm saying it's good, Hiller. I'm just saying that's kind of what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's just,
that's what we grow up being socialized to think. And so my place on it was like, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to be the stay-at-home dad. I'm not going to go off chasing clouds. I'm going to be a stay-at-home dad because that's what I can do right now. So I was like, my efforts to be enlightened actually had me turn it down. And then Karen kind of smacked me upside the head. isn't this the place whose games you always play? Like all of their games? And you said this was like your dream job? And I kind of went, yeah. So then Karen had me apply.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
Lot of wives would do that.
She's amazingly, she has supported all of my ludicrous dreams with far more patience than is necessary, I think.
That's amazing.
And I got the offer to interview with BioWare on the day we came home from the hospital with my son.
Wow.
It's kind of like day of changes. I'm like coming home from the hospital, you know, 26 hours of labor.
Yikes.
And I'm like, okay, where do I get the crib ready? Do I, you know, okay, well, let's see what the email is. Oh, they want to interview me. I don't have the ability to deal with that right now.
That's a lot of change.
That's pretty amazing. And then, of course, you end up getting hired, and then you make us some awesome games. So thank you.
Well, part of a very small part of a very large team doing a ton of awesome stuff.
That's
like I said, coming to BioWare has been really, really amazing. It's like Clarion West, except Clarion West lasted 6 weeks, and you know this has lasted for me 7 years now. And
wow,
that is amazing.
Keeps getting better. People who, you know, they like the jokes, they make their own jokes, and people who challenge you. And that I don't know. I think the only other writing advice I have like beyond the you know, this line is not so great level, is you have to be around people who challenge you, like people who they should support what you want to be, what you want to do. Like, you don't want to be around someone who's like, you know, I hate what you're writing. You should write something completely different. But you do need to be around people who are like, okay, I know this is the kind of writer you want to be, but this isn't here. And if you want to do it, you know, this would help, or, you know, get to this place if this is what you want to do.
Yeah.
Well, and it's fun because you can see how much you interact with people, even just online. So people following you on Twitter, for example, can see, you know, the banter that you have with your colleagues. And his Twitter, by the way, is at Patrick Weeks. But yeah, I mean, I watch it all the time, and literally it cracks me up. There's some days that are so bad at work, I go onto Twitter and I just start cracking up.
Oh, absolutely.
And everybody at the office has no idea why. And it's like my super secret joke. I'm like, I'm there in spirit with you, Patrick.
That's
making the bad puns, critiquing Dave Feltham's pineapple chopping skills.
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of funny things going on Twitter with you guys.
It's true.
So we have a lot of questions to go through, some of which we're gonna kind of segue into the Palace job because we have a lot of questions about that too. But while we're on the topic of some BioWare stuff, my question was, if they approached you and allowed you to write a spinoff of the Mass Effect series, what do you think you would want to write it about? If you had total creative control,
if I had
picked the team and everything, and they're like, sure, hey, make a Mass Effect spinoff. What would the Patrick Weeks, other than the musical that everyone was tweeting at me about?
Well, there is the musical, yeah. You know, it's tough. It's tough because inside BioWare, there's a box. There's a box of possibility and budget requirements, ideas, assets.
I really hope it's an actual physical box that when
you
open it,
you have to get into it. Okay. Now write out your plot. Does it fit? Okay. Yeah, but just trying to get, so, okay. Off the top of my head, some of my favorite parts of writing the Mass Effect stuff, of the stuff I got to write, I love the slice of life moments. I love the moments where we got to show, that's why Mass Effect 3, I was always, amazed at how we tried to make a world a galaxy at war. But in Mass Effect 2, the nice thing about it was that most of the galaxy was in denial about the collectors. And so when you're walking around Ilium or the Citadel or, even Tuchanka, you could really just kind of say, here's what people's ordinary lives are like.
Yeah, I love that feeling, because the universe felt very lived in, and that's one of the things that really made Mass 2 stand out for me, is the fact that you could go, to a place like Omega or wherever and be wow, this is just, I kind of just want to go here and hang out.
So, on the game level, I would always love to do ship combat, because I was a big fan of any of you guys play Star Control 2?
Oh my gosh, Patrick. I don't understand what just happened to my pants.
Oh my gosh.
But if you could do Star Control 2,
of course,
an equivalent in the Mass Effect universe where you got ship combat, but you still have role playing, you're upgrading your ship. I would love to do that. I think.
Sometimes when my wife is mad at me, I still go, launch fighters, launch fighters.
launch fight, yes. Then you wonder why your Urquan Dreadnought has only 3 health left. But a lot of fighters got launched.
Can we start a petition to bring that game back in some capacity? Because
So if I remember right, the copyright stuff got weird. So it's not called Star Control 2. But if you do a search for the Urquan Masters, it's actually free. There's a free game out there.
Yeah, I think I had that on my PC a few years back. But I'm being selfish and I want like a nice like.
Well, I would love. Yeah.
Yes. I want BioWare to make me one. So.
That would be cool. So I would love to do that. I would love to do. I'd love to do some stuff in history. Like the history of the Mass Effect universe, because there's so much stuff that it informed the trilogy. But there's stuff I would love to see what happened when people got their hands dirty, making the Genophage.
That'd be very cool.
Yeah, like the Krogan Rebellion, like the Rachni Wars, like.
I'd love to see Rachni Wars. That'd be great.
Yeah, like all of that I would love to see. For me, it's just all, it's kind of all over the board. I came to Mass Effect 1 late enough that, I was really lucky because the world, all the main writers had already made the IP for Mass Effect by the time I came onto Mass 1. So I just got to play in it. And I guess I've never stopped loving playing in that world.
That's great. That's really great. So our next question is just about a little bit about your technique and where do you like to write? And when you kind of sit down to write a story or to tell a story, like how do you begin and sort of like where is your zen place for actually writing? Because I hear it's different for every single writer.
Is it a desktop computer on a bed?
my sweet, sweet lifestyle. Cribs with Patrick and Karen in their flooded basement. Yeah, so for me, I live in my own head enough that place doesn't really matter to me. That's not necessarily a good thing. That's just kind of how it is. But so I can be on kind of any kind of computer. I wrote most of one novel actually on a Palm Pilot with an attachable keyboard.
Well, that's impressive.
Yeah, it ended up giving me really, really short paragraphs because I would think, man, this paragraph's long. I have to break it up. And then I would like copy it over to the computer and realize that it only looked long on the Palm Pilot screen.
Yeah.
So I had this very like short, choppy style. And I'm like, wow, I got really concise, man. But so I have kind of a ritual for like when I want to start writing. For me, if I can't write for at least, say, an hour to an hour and a half, it's not really worth it. I kind of snowball in my writing. So like the first 15 minutes, I'm just kind of clearing my throat, figuring out what I did and when I stopped writing last night and getting to where to go. But if I can have like a 2-hour stretch or, back in the pre-kids days, like a 3 or 4 hour stretch, that's when I can really get into it. And every time I do that, I'll almost always write to music.
Oh, yeah?
Yep. I used to write to stuff with words that had, like, the right mood. In fact, at work, I still write to stuff with words. But in my writing at home, I can't do it anymore. The words are just too distracting. I don't know if it's because I'm writing the prose or what, rather than just writing dialogue. I used to write to, like, really, really hard, angry, powerful music, like Don Henley. I'm kind of a music wuss, and Karen will attest to that. I'm at peace with it. I'm not gonna. My musical taste is what
it's
it
totally
is.
Fine. It's totally fine.
Some Eagle, Kenny G. Ooh.
We have Eagles, a variety of tastes here. Hillary listens
Eagles,
nothing
Freezes
but booty
Over
bass.
Is a very good album. Anyway, I'd write to that sometimes, but these days it's almost all soundtracks that I write to. Like finding something that gives me the right vibe.
Ooh, I love it.
Yeah, whatever people feel about like the Transformers soundtrack or the Transformers movie anyway. Whether you like it, hate it, whatever. I think the Transformers, the Michael Bay stuff, all of the soundtracks are great. Like you want to write some action scenes or something, you have the right music there. Pirates of the Caribbean, like all the recent Marvel movies. Mm-hmm. So like Captain America.
It's really like the epic style.
We used to play D&D to the Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yes!
we'd crank that up and play for like 4 hours.
That or we get on Last FM and type in Viking metal.
Yes! We played D&D to Viking metal, and that was just, you were throwing those dice and just screaming.
So yeah, it's almost all soundtracks for me these days, unless I'm writing a love scene or something, and then I will sometimes pick out whatever weird specialty music I have in mind. Yeah, so it gets us back to the question about figuring out whether it's a scene, a character, a pivotal moment in the story. For me, it's about figuring out what that is, and then figuring out how to get there. And you kind of have that on like the macro level and the micro level, if that makes any sense. Like without getting too deep into spoilers for Palace Job, there was something I knew I wanted to do with a character. And I said, okay, here's this character. And you break it down to the point where you can say in one sentence what that character is. Like what's your favorite? Okay. This is the part where I totally nerd out on dialogue for a moment because I did this with a voice actress at one point. She and I were just, isn't this the best line of dialogue ever? Okay, Kung Fu Panda. All
right. Love it.
Yeah, so you can tell I go to the really deep literary stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Kung Fu Panda. A better movie than it has any right to be.
Sure.
Because you look at the voice acting and they all just brought their A game. People came to that movie and you're like, don't you know you're just in a fun little DreamWorks action talking animals movie? And like, but people were like, I'm doing the acting. I'm gonna make it real. And they just blow those scenes out of the water. And for me, the scene that I love is, this has a point, trust me.
Angelina Jolie, huh? No.
Yes, it is. No, it absolutely is. It's Angelina Jolie telling Poe about, oh God, now I'm going to forget his name. Was it Tian Lung? Who's the bad guy? Al Swearengen.
It's been a while. I haven't seen it since the theater.
But she's telling the story, right? Do you remember? So you remember the story when she's telling in the flashback sequence?
Yep, vaguely.
Master Shifu training, and then his student grows up and gets powerful and goes bad.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And then Master Tigress, Angelina Jolie, says, you know, Shifu loved him more than he had, like a son, more than he had loved any of his students before. And then it cuts to Tigress as a little cub doing her own punch on the silly panda bag. And she does a great punch and knocks it across the room. And she looks over to Master Shifu for approval. And all he does is, with the cane, he just moves her arm and her leg into the proper stance and moves on. And Angelina Jolie, in present narrator voice, narrating the flashback, just says, "Or since." And in that moment right there, I was like, oh my God, Angelina Jolie, that was like two words. And you just brought tears to my eyes. And it was, and that scene right there, that's like, you can write for years doing voiceover, you know, that an actor's going to say, and never get something that perfect. You know, if you're lucky, you get that a couple of times in your career to have a line like that, where you're like, right there, the actress absolutely knew, you know, here's the character saying, realizing she has actually been a little bit more emotionally vulnerable than she wanted to be. And she is saying it with so few words, and she is, you know, it's quick and it's fast. She's selling the fact that she doesn't, she's midway through the line and realizes she probably shouldn't have said it. Hmm. And she's trusting in the, you know, and this is Angelina Jolie sitting in front of a microphone, trusting in the art to sell that. And so you get a moment like that. And that, for me, like those special moments that I can think about and hear years later, and still remember, those are what I think of as my pivotal moments that I can go, okay, so this scene that I'm writing, I'm going to use that as my reference point. Mm-hmm. I'm not ripping it off. I'm not, you know, ha ha. And then Patrick tried to, you know, steal that Angelina Jolie two word line. But
or since.
Or since. It's just littered throughout the book. Or since.
Man, every scene. It's what the hell? No, but this is your reference point. And as a writer, you should be collecting those moments. Every time something moves you, you should be a slightly sociopathic, detached clinical person who goes like, wow, I was totally moved by that. Okay, why was I? Was it the camera angle? Okay, that was a good line. That was good delivery. I'm going to use that later. And you should have those kind of like if physical 3x5 cards, mental 3x5 cards, a wiki, whatever it is you do, that like, okay, so what am I going to do in this scene? This is the scene where I have an emotional revelation and I need something powerful. What is my starting point? Well, okay. Yeah, Angelina Jolie's flashback. That it's gonna be my version of that, and it's gonna be different characters telling a different story, but because I have that to start off with as this kind of universal truth, and it doesn't have to be deep and meaningful. I mean, there are times when I've been bantering back and forth with Dumbra about something. John Dumbra, sorry, one of the other writers, another senior writer on Mass Effect, a fantastic guy, and he and I'll be bantering back and forth, and you know, well, how about, okay, did you see this movie? And when this happened, yeah, okay. So you're talking about when Sean Connery is talking to this guy and he says that one line. Yeah, that one. Okay, and then later like two scenes. Yeah, okay, good. We're going to do that. And you just form those as your reference points. And it's you know, people, there are only so many emotions in the human psychology and only so many words we have and only so many types of stories. And as you build that narrative, just being able to reference those and hit them in a very structural and logical way without losing the passion you had that got you to feel, you know, whatever you felt in that scene in the first place, be it humor or anger or sadness. You know, that's what makes the scenes kick.
That's awesome. That's very
cool. Sorry,
I mean, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, there are a lot of moments like in films that I watch and things like that do, you know, stick with me for a very long time. And, you know, I don't write in the same capacity that you do, but I definitely, you know, use those when I do. So,
hello, Morden.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a little bit of Morden there, huh?
Morden's pretty amazing. So,
he is. Yeah.
Okay, so the funny thing about this is, if anyone listening to this has not played Mass Effect 3, I don't want to spoil anything.
Highly unlikely.
Yeah. Okay. But
done the demographics. We're pretty
sure. At the risk of pulling the curtain back a little too far. So on Morden, John Dumbrow, you know, owned the scene, and I came in with the Morden character voice on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it, and Mac had some fantastic advice that made it better, and Casey had some fantastic advice that made it better, and we were really honing the hell out of the renegade side.
I have yet to play that because I'm too terrified.
Again, be slightly sociopathic. One of the happiest, coolest moments you can have as a writer on any kind of interactive fiction is having someone say, "I tried to play that path, and then I started crying, and I cried some more, and then I had to go back and reload, and I can't be renegade anymore."
Oh, I'm so afraid.
Yeah, and, I can't do it. I know it. I heard what happens, and I can't do it.
Well, you know, you've been playing as Paragon. I was crying my ass out.
Like, just knowing that you were part of a team, you know, the voice actor, the music, John Ebinger on the cine design, you know, a part of a team that made something that essentially made a collection of pixels affect somebody's behavior to a point where they changed what they wanted to do.
That is again, amazing.
That's just one of those absolutely. Like, wow, you get that again. If you're lucky, you get that a couple of times a career, and you know,
You wrote a lot of the Corian stuff in 3 as well, right?
I wrote some of it, yeah. Oh, okay, but on the Morden side. So okay. What was interesting is on the betrayal side, the side that so few people end up wanting to do.
Yeah.
You know, we really honed the hell out of that because we were like, wow, this is really uncomfortable. I hate having to do this. How about now? Now does it work? Okay, now it's still not quite right. Now I'm a jerk for doing it. No, now I don't realize I'm going to do it. And so we, you know, just as a team, everyone busted the hell out of that. When then the writers collectively played through it, and one of our writers, Sylvia, played through it and said, yeah, the Renegade side, that was fantastic. That was amazing. Paragon side didn't really do it for me. she said, it wasn't bad. There wasn't anything wrong with it. It didn't pop. I'm paraphrasing her. Like Sylvia's gonna, you know, angrily be on Twitter saying, well, "I never." but she gave us the best possible feedback, which is, you know,
it could be better.
Yeah,
it just didn't resonate. Yeah.
And so going to the list of 3x5 cards, Hunt for Red October.
Oh, of course.
Great movie.
Okay, so I can't remember the names. Sean Connery talking to his first officer about what they're going to do when they get to America. And Sean Connery doesn't know what he's going to do or has an idea. And his first officer says something about going to start a corn farm in Kansas or a corn farm in Iowa. I can't remember where it is.
Yeah.
And then near the end of the movie, the first officer is killed by the spy, right?
Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert.
Okay, sorry.
he ruined it for me. Ugh.
And he says, looks like I'm not going to get that corn farm in Kansas or Iowa or wherever it was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was like one of his last lines. And that was the 3x5 card that John brought up. And that's how we got the seashells.
Oh, okay.
Because we were like, okay, yeah, he's going, he's sacrificing himself, he's doing this thing, but we don't have the humanizing, mundane, simple element that connects him to ordinary life and therefore makes it sadder that he is going to leave it.
Mm. Right.
And so, you know, I'm pleased to see that people didn't read that, you know, play that moment and then go, Dumbrow and Weeks, those assholes, they just ripped off Hunt for Red October, you know. Because,
Well, now they will.
Now they know the truth. It'll be all over the internet.
But, you know, that was what we looked at. We're like, okay, yeah, that was a humanizing element right there. And you have it once early on, and then you have it again so that you don't have to spell out a full humanizing element. If Morden hadn't said anything early on when you talked to him in the lab, and then, you know, going up to the tower, if he had just suddenly introduced, you know, I was really hoping to retire and spend, well, okay, now it's kind of cliche. Now he's talking about it as he's doing it. But if all he has to say is, would have liked to run tests on the seashells, suddenly it's calling back to everything you had before. And it lets the player fill in the humanity.
Yeah, that scene was probably one of my favorite in the whole series. So, you guys done well.
Yeah, it's an amazing team effort.
Yeah, and I'm a rather emotionless robot of a person.
Except when you're talking about like penises.
And I get very excited.
Oh, geez. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's an appropriate time to have emotions. I mean.
So let's transition from that into the palace job.
Good idea.
Is there a way to do that?
It's a penis center.
Well, I mean, you could say that a palace job. Never mind.
Don't go there.
Well, let's get to the heart of the matter. You liking these Don Henley puns at all?
Yeah.
It was good. It was good.
All right.
I recently, I can't remember the con, honestly, but at one of the cons I went to, I got to sit on a panel for Margaret Weiss from Dragonlance. And
oh, yeah, okay.
It was good. It was really awesome. But one of the things she talked about with her writing process that I had never really thought about with sci-fi books before or fantasy books is that Tracy Hickman, her partner, actually did most of the world planning, and then she did all the character planning. And it really made me think about, like, oh, man, you know, I used to do that with D&D without even thinking about it, like create a world first, and then I would kind of delve into what some of the characters would be. And I was wondering what your kind of process is. Do you start with the world, or do you have a notion of characters, or do you go, like, way off the deep end on one before you start creating the other, or how do you go with that?
Actually, for me, I would be surprised if it were that different from what Margaret and Tracy did. Because I kind of come to writing from a Dungeon Master background as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of the novels that I wrote, you know, kind of came after I was working on, after I was running, you know, my buddies through a third edition D&D game, and we went from first level to 20th level, and because we all worked at the same startup company for a while before it died, the campaign had a wiki, and so we were, you know, okay, incredible. Well, this town's over here, and this is this world's term for beholders, and, you know, so we had this whole thing mapped out. And so for me, some of that is how some of that crossed over to books. Like I have a tendency to go overboard and then have to rein myself in.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of remind myself that, you know, I'm not making a game. I'm not running a game. This all has to be in service to the novel. And it's not absolutely necessary for the novel. You know, maybe it's something I'll use a couple books later if it's a series, but it can't get in the way of what I'm doing.
Sure.
So I tend to kind of do a mix. I kind of try to establish a general baseline. Like in the palace job, I had my basic ideas. Like, okay, here are the countries around me. At least, you know, as long as I can get away with it, the countries will never be named. They will just be different types of countries. Mm-hmm. You know, the Republic is a republic and, you know, ostensibly does not have kings, even though it has very rich people who, you know, kind of almost do the same thing. And, you know, and the Republic is near the Empire. And, okay, and the Empire, you know, presumably has an emperor. But I'm not, you know, so like my thing was, okay, I'm going to very deliberately not get into the details on that. And if my baseline for the Republic is it's as close as I can get to modern sensibilities in not fake Europe fantasy land, but but I would say almost the, you know, it's the modern fantasy feel. Like, how close can I get to modern sensibilities if people are still on horseback?
Yeah, and it also, you know, it helps the audience to identify with your location if they have some sort of real world, you know, parallel. So, I mean, that's I think it, you know, it is important. You just don't want to like start spouting like nonsense about like, you know, multiple dimensions and, you know, gobbledygook, and people are like, what the hell am I reading? So I think it is important to like have some sort of,
well,
have it be,
I mean,
grounded,
some authors, you know? Well, some authors do that. And it's interesting because that doesn't do it for me. That's not the kind of stuff I enjoy reading. But for a lot of readers, that is what they enjoy reading, especially in science fiction and fantasy. There are some writers who, this is going to sound negative, and I don't know how to make it not sound negative.
Just say it really, say it very positively.
Like, I will totally, But it's like the fiction is the, it's like puzzle fiction, where like part of the enjoyment you get as a reader is trying to figure out what the hell is going on.
Ah.
Where you're like, as a reader, you're like, okay, you just threw like 12 alien words at me, and I don't know, is that a ship, or is that the way the ship goes, or is that, okay, that's definitely an alien. No, that's a culture, and the alien is in that culture. Shit, okay, I don't remember who's who anymore. And there are people for whom that is the enjoyment they get. It's like what they really want is an incredibly, you know, information-rich world that they can just sink their minds into. And I respect that. That's definitely not what I write. You know, it's not what I write. It's not what I personally enjoy reading, but you know, I'm glad that people out there write it, because you know, other people really want to read that.
Yeah.
More power to them.
That's cool.
That's awesome.
So the characters in The Palace Job, I have to say, I mean, they're amazing. I mean, they all have, you know, very distinct voices, you know, so I always hate when you read a book and everyone sounds the same. That's probably one of my biggest critiques of a lot of the books that I've read, at least lately. And so when I read The Palace Job, I was really excited to, you know, read something and know, this Dora said that, or especially like, you know, the talking weapon, the Warhammer, shall I say. So,
my favorite character.
Yes, no, but I have
to turn into my talking magical weapon roots.
There you go.
Yes, exactly. But you, okay, I'm going to say this and I'm sure I'm going to butcher it, but she's probably my favorite character, like favorite. It's Eulalemia.
Okay, so Karen and I have had a long, Karen supports me. Karen is incredibly patient. She is loving and tolerant. And wow, does she hate that name.
It's recognizable, and it's, you know,
it's a beautifully over the top name. That's the entire point.
It's perfect. You know what I mean? Yeah. So how did you come up with that name?
My name process is both, I spend more time on it than I probably should. because like, I think it's funny at BioWare, I think Dave Gator and I are like two people, we kind of have a kindred spirit in terms of caring way too much about names.
Love it.
Where we will just kind of be like, okay, well, what are you going to name him? Oh, I don't know. I need like an hour for that. Hold on. It's got to be, no, it doesn't feel like an M. it can't have a K in it. It's not that hard. You want to feel soft when you're saying it. You want to feel, and like, you know, like so actually jokes. Saying out loud to another writer, no, it can't be that, because you have to close your mouth midway through saying the name. And this isn't a character that people have to close their mouth while they're saying that person's name. And like having the other writers look at you and go like, what the hell? Really? Seriously? So I'm not saying that's healthy, but Eulalemia, the entire point of her character is she's a unicorn. No spoilers.
She's not just a unicorn. She's amazing.
Yeah. And she's on the cover, so it's not that much of a spoiler. and so the point of Eulalemia was street smart? Street smart, urbane, people who I thought of as being sharp, sarcastic, incisive.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed somebody nice. But I also needed the nice person to not just be a doormat. So I was like, yeah, I need a hippie. I needed Phoebe from Friends. Phoebe from Friends could have been part of the Ocean's 11 crew. Again, if you go to your character, you guess that's in the 3x5 cards, Phoebe from Friends, you're like, okay, there you go. Like goofy, crystal banging hippie, but you just like, then you add on like, okay, but what if Phoebe were part of Ocean's 11.
And a unicorn.
And a unicorn, yes.
And she has I'm not going to spoil it for people, but she has a certain affinity for something that's pretty outstanding. So
she She has, yes.
Yes.
She has interests.
Awesome.
So yeah, so I was like, okay, so whatever her name is, it has to reflect that. She can't be Susan. She can't be, can't sound like a normal fantasy name. It has to sound like something that on the surface is a little bit goofy. And that's where, like, yeah, Eulalinia very deliberately came. All right, that sounds like it ululates. It, for some reason, I thought that unicorn and ululate sounded kind of alike. And I was like, yeah, that's where it's going. That is most Dungeons and Dragons goofy fantasy name.
I love it.
That I get.
So along with that, I know I was reading, I'm still reading it, but I was reading it today and I hit a part where I felt like I was almost reading French. I think it was the common language is what they said. And then some of the languages seem very Germanic and very heavy. And I didn't know.
So I had French. I had French. Yeah. That's the language from the old country, the old kingdom.
So that was French.
Oh, that. Well, okay. Let's
or
be
close,
honest. That was
mutated French.
That was Patrick's high school French.
Yeah, there you go.
So I'd like to apologize to any actual French speakers. although Anne LeMay, who's from Montreal, native, I think she's native Quebecois. She didn't say my French was atrocious, so maybe it's okay.
There you go. I would be no judge. But and then some of it seems like North Germanic. Like it seems almost like Swedish or.
Oh, and then there's the stuff I totally made up.
Is that made up? Okay.
Oh yeah, totally made up. Because again, you play enough Dungeons and Dragons campaigns, eventually you are going to make your own language.
There you go. So is this mapped out? Is it a mapped out language then? Or is this...
Oh yeah. On my wiki, on my like not my public wiki, like on my private wiki, I have here are the verbs and here are the nouns.
That's incredible,
awesome.
It's goofy.
That's really impressive. I think that's really
I will flat out say there are people for whom this is a very deep and like this is what they do in their spare time. They synthetic languages. They make their own languages and convince other people to learn their language. Like they go into really deep things about like, okay, here are the, you know, the phonemes, the morphological constraints that I am a dabbler by comparison. Like I do not have any languages that you could actually use to program a VCR. Like my languages are at this is a bad thing. And if I put this pronoun or this little bit at the front, it becomes bad person instead of bad thing.
Still, that's really cool.
It works though. I mean, it's not so heavy that it's not like so heavy handed that I feel like I'm lost at certain points. It just
there's one point where I use it for like multiple sentences in a row, and the only reason I did that was because it was in the service of a really goofy joke, which was very important to me for some reason.
Was that the your mom joke?
Yes.
I appreciate it.
It was in fact a Yo Mama joke.
Every book should have at least two of those.
Yeah, I can tell Matt really likes the book. He just got it on his Kindle. And he's just like tearing through it. So good job, Matt.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, if you're at the ancient language Yo Mama joke, then you're a fair amount through.
Yeah.
The ancient language Yo Mama joke. I love it.
So the only Swedish word, because I go to Sweden an awful lot, the only Swedish word that I can contribute is Systembolaget, and that means liquor store.
Holy crap, that's awesome.
Hillary,
there you go.
Do you go there because you look like you should go there?
No. No, I go there for work, but...
I would just like to say.
I would just like to say. Stop it.
What do you mean, you people?
Exactly.
We're racist against Swedes on this podcast.
You've chosen an interesting racist target.
That's a weird thing to be racist against.
Aw.
Oh, and you can see
you people.
And awesome is Tulpen.
Awesome
liquor store.
Those are the only things you know?
Yeah. Awesome liquor store. That's good.
Please reference the beginning of the podcast and the things that I said about Hillary.
Shush. And tack is thank you. Tack.
Nice.
Yes, so that's my contribution, just because that's awesome. So I have a question.
Sure.
So you have a lot of really strong female protagonists, and that's something that's definitely, as Scott and Matt and Ash would say, in my wheelhouse. So did actually in the character Locke obviously personifies this quite a lot. So did Locke actually start off this way? Did you kind of think, I want to have a woman that's powerful and, you know, street smart, like you said, or, I mean, how did she come together?
So I think, that's the right way to put this. There are, I was talking about this with a friend, and there are different kind of degrees of inclusions of anything that is not a white male in general fiction, but especially in science fiction and fantasy, I think. One level is you just have them in there and they kind of sit on the sidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And the author goes like, look, I included persons of color. Aren't I awesome?
And they're beautiful.
Yeah, they're great. I totally approve of them. Moving on. Yeah. And so that's kind of like one end of the spectrum. And then at the other end of the spectrum is, you know, for me at least, there is the fiction that is really about that character. And not just about that character, but about the experience of being that type of person. I'm remembering like Nicola Griffith has, I read Slow River, and, you know, it's a fantastic piece, a fantastic novel. Probably getting either the name or the book wrong because I don't have a computer in front of me except for the one that I'm using to look at Ash's face.
And pancakes.
Yeah. So that, you know, something that really delves into that. I see Locke and kind of the palace job as being kind of somewhere in the middle. I did want to write something that was not white male save the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we have a lot of that, and I wanted to do something different. But I also know that I don't know enough to write something that is explicitly, this is what it's like to be a person of color, a woman of color, in fake fantasy land.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I do not have that, and I would botch that so hard. But just because I know that I can't tackle the issues on an incredibly deep level does not mean that I should just write white guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think you balance, you know, she doesn't come off like, you know, this woman has to be strong, therefore I'm writing her strong, the end. You know, you are able to balance some degrees of vulnerability, and she has such an interesting story, you know, just about her life, that you can really understand why she is the way she is. So that was pretty profound, because I've also read a lot of books that are like, I'm going to capitalize on strong female protagonists. Yay. And then it just doesn't come off as believable at all, because there is the element of her being a woman.
Right. Well, and that's kind of what I was going to say is that, oh, sorry, did you?
No, go ahead.
I was going to say that it's the same, the book, kind of in the same way that I feel about Mass Effect. It's not that I read it and go like, yeah, strong female character. It just seems like a strong character to me. Like, I just enjoy reading. The gender doesn't have to play, you know, a key role. Sorry, I live in Brooklyn, everybody. you can hear that.
Oh, yeah.
But the character doesn't have to, or the gender doesn't have to play like a certain role in the character to me to appreciate it or to like the story or enjoy it, you know. Whereas I'm with you, Hillary, where sometimes it's like, I feel like they're like, look, I'm doing a strong female character. Aren't you proud of me? And you're like, mm-hmm. What? So.
Yeah, you don't get a cookie for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think one of the, if I'm remembering right, I think it's Greg Rucka. When someone said, why do you write strong female characters and so many of your comic books and graphic novels, his you know, he'll obviously have the long, intelligent answer, but the short answer is because people keep asking me that question. Because people still see a strong female character as something that is like that noteworthy and weird.
Right.
That's a really good point.
And that, you know, I like, as one of a team of, what is it, 5 on Mass 1 and 9 on Mass 2 and 3 of writers, you know, not to mention the artists, the voice actors, cine designers, everyone, you know, as part of that whole team, I am really proud to be part of a game that can make, you know, where you can make a person of color and have that not be a thing. And have, you know, and whatever that can do to help normalize it so that you do not have to say, and she's a woman. Isn't that amazing? It's a woman. What if it was like a demon slayer, but a woman? How crazy is that? Yeah. You're like, well, it's not crazy at all. Like,
I mean, I think you guys did a great job of making some of the aliens as well. I mean, the first time you have a community of people that are like in love with alien species.
And, so true.
I mean, like literally, like, and that's the first time I've ever seen that. And I've been, I mean, not, I mean, obviously people like, you know, loved the old Star Wars characters and Star Trek characters and, you know, different science fiction, but not to the level that they really fell in love with a lot of the mass characters, I believe, because they
I think Spock has his thing going on.
That is true. He does have a harem of women.
True.
But, you know, you look at it like a Turian and you put it next to Spock. Spock looks pretty much just like us.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, but then you give it Brandon Keener's voice and the pants just fly off.
So
it's
true.
A little outstanding. Yeah.
All right. So we actually have to did you have something else?
Oh, no. The only other thing I was going to add on Locke, and this is an incredibly minor thing, but it's one of those little things, was When I was making them, I still come at it from a role-playing background at times. And I almost always try to think of it in terms of, if not Dungeons & Dragons, at least in some role-playing system, how would I build this person? Which is a little geeky. But, you know, I'm at peace with that. And the key thing on Locke that I wanted to do, and it's funny because it started just purely physically, and then it ended up kind of affecting more of her character from that, is Locke almost never nimbly dodges an attack. Because I did not want here you have big powerful hulking warrior, and then, you know, like, what, how many video games, you know, back in the old days, or even to some extent the new days, where it's like, yeah, if you're the guy, you're the big hulking warrior with the awesome sword and the big shield, and if you're the woman, you're the sorceress, or you're the archer, and you're fast and nimble and you dodge.
Yeah,
and so my thing with Locke was, Locke takes punches, and, you know, she's not dumb. She doesn't always like take them on the jaw, but you know, she's a boxer, not a dancer.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, and that ended up affecting a lot of her character development. Like, she's a boxer, not a dancer. She's like rarely going to gracefully just ignore something and like, haha, I'm untouched. Like, she gets hit by things in the plot, like, you know, emotional events as well, but she takes it.
Yeah, I think Aveline in DA2 was the first female character that I saw that was really portrayed in that way at all. And
I loved Aveline.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of us BioWare fans really like that character for that reason. She's a very believable, and, you know, really well-rounded, so we like her.
Yeah.
But speaking of women who are sorceresses, in a sense, Desidora, amazing. So the way that she, I'm not going to spoil again. I want to spoil so bad, but the way that she's able to demonstrate her power is amazing. So, and you feel like it, you're watching it.
Also not to spoil it, but the her introduction scene reminded me so much, if you've seen the Avengers, of Scarlett Johansson's
oh my god, yeah, you're totally right. And I mean, I wrote this 5 years ago, and I hope it doesn't look like I ripped off the Avengers, but yes, you're absolutely right.
not in a rip-off way, but just in kind of that like badass, like, you're like, what is happening? And then, you know, it was just awesome. So
incredible.
Yes.
Cool. Well, we have a ton of questions from the community, and we're going to kind of do them in rapid fire way. So we'll shout out the handle of the person that asked you the question, and then answer it.
I can answer or swear at the person who asked.
Yeah, you can answer or swear. There are some.
Excellent. You just might.
There are some from your buddies here, so I think.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think you're going to have some funny ones.
All right, what do we got?
So these are our community questions. The first one is from Christina Grenhart, who is at CL Grenhart on Twitter, and she asked, I think more than anyone else, she must have asked over a dozen questions. So we're going to choose some of hers. So she was very eager, and she says, how do you balance writing prose with your job and your family? So it is a nice question. We're starting with the nice ones.
Oh yes. I think easy, loving and supportive spouse is the fast answer. It's, and honestly, there's no magic solution beyond sacrifice. I play far fewer games than I want to. I have to pick games that I really, really care about, and those are the ones I play, and everything else I cut, and it goes to writing time.
Excellent. Go ahead, Hillary.
All right, so Gaynor Legaspi. I always say his name.
That's why. That's why.
No, that's why we left it for you.
That's amazing. And it's at Regaynor, R-E-Gaynor. So how is writing for a video game different than writing prose for a novel?
Oh, the short answer is cocktail party versus battle scene. So in a video game, if you have a good combat engine, you can have an amazing battle scene. And it's not like it's easy. The level designers and combat designers do a shit ton of work to make that stuff awesome. But you can have a really incredibly detailed, powerful fight. But if you want to have a cocktail party in a video game, it's incredibly expensive because, well, yeah, okay, I want 40 people, and all of the people, I want to be able to talk to all 40 people. They're all going to have conversations that I could optionally go in and get involved with. That's absurd. Having 40 different people, you have to have the memory assets, you have to have the animation to do lip sync for every time they talk. It's almost impossible to do a good cocktail party in a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a book, cocktail party is easy. It's just people talking. I can do people talking all day long. You ask me to do a battle scene, and suddenly I have to describe the vista. I have to describe the pounding of the hoofbeats. There's so much on my part that I have to describe. It's a ton harder.
Right.
And it's just, honestly, video game writing plays to my strengths because I really enjoy dialogue. I have fun writing it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of terrible at setting. At every first draft, I remember I wrote something that was in Victorian London, and at the end of the first draft, someone, you know, very politely said, "Patrick, London is more than just cobblestones and fog." Because that was pretty much my setting for London. It was, yeah, he walked on cobblestones. It was foggy. And then I did a whole bunch of dialogue because that was what I knew how to do. So, like, my future drafts are always going through and putting in setting, but that's kind of why, you know, working on games like this is so amazing because I have level artists who are fantastic at, you know, making places. So I don't have to.
That's awesome. Very cool.
At Eric Halston asks, Weeks, moving from LA to Edmonton, be honest, you feel cooler than anyone else, right? Also, I wonder if Nerd Appropriate can finally get an explanation for Morden's metallic headphone rig thinging out of Weeks.
All right.
It's a two-part question.
So it's actually, for me, it wasn't LA, it was Bay Area, so San Francisco.
Oh, cool.
I would say I feel colder than anybody else. I'm not sure about cooler.
Oh.
But yeah, coming from California to Edmonton is it's a fun experience. I really love the pace of life up here. I think people are really, really polite. And when I come back to California, I'm amazed that I put up with like 2.5 hour daily round trip commutes.
Ouch.
As like just a thing that I did during the day. And now I'm like, wow, yeah, it's 5 minutes to work. Well, 10 minutes if it's snowing. But then on the other hand, we go back home and we go back to California for Christmas, and my sons run around and all of their cousins are in heavy coats and scarves and stuff. and the boys are running around without coats on. They're like, it's above freezing. It's not that cold. And everyone is looking at us weird. So
awesome.
We've kind of gotten our Canadian things. As for Morden's thing, I think that's actually probably more of a Matt Rhodes question. Because, you know, I could be remembering that wrong, but I thought he was one of the original concept guys for Morden. And I apologize to the character artist if I got that wrong. I think it's part of a PDA. I think Morden actually talks and thinks so quickly that just typing something on an Omni tool wouldn't be able to cut it. And so he actually has that thing that's like his techno version of like Siri for the iPhone. And he's just rattling on at, you know, several hundred words a minute, and that little thing is just taking it in.
I like Google that explanation. Glasses.
Very good.
A mimic.
So, next up is some guy named Mike Laidlaw. And he says, Patrick,
I don't have time for the trolls, okay? Laidlaw. He wants to know, what kind of a name is that?
Where do you get the nerve?
Damn, he's going to the office. So I would say to Mr. Laidlaw that if I stand so tall, it is only so that I may kiss the asses of giants.
Great answer.
That's amazing.
The next question is from, I also believe from your office, Joss Hendricks. And he says, for weeks, how does it feel to be the singular writing professional that likes CSI jokes unironically?
It feels fucking fabulous. Thank you. And it is a point of great disappointment to me that Lair of the Shadow Broker did not open with with the forensics people going over the evidence in Liara's apartment and then saying, looks like her barriers ended up just like her morals.
Yeah.
I may have pitched that to the lead designer and got a very polite you're fired.
That is unbelievable.
So Ritzy at Ritzy Fox, Fox with two X's, having written both sci-fi Mass Effect and fantasy Pyle's Job, which do you prefer to write and why?
Oh, good question. The wussy take no sides answer is I like both, but I like them for different reasons, and so it depends on what kind of story I want to tell. I like fantasy if I want to tell something about if the world is more involved. Mm-hmm. I like science fiction if I don't have to make the world, because my organic chemistry scores will indicate I'm not heavy science guy. I can do enough science not to embarrass myself, but then science guy has to come in and go, okay, Patrick, change that line, and that plot, because you broke the science. So fantasy is where if I want the world to be a little more, if I want the world to have a heavy impact, and science fiction for me is if I'm telling a personal story that just happens to take place on spaceships, or if someone else has already done all the heavy lifting for me, like in the Mass Effect franchise, where, a dedicated team of people who know a ton more about that than I ever will have set the rules and parameters.
Excellent.
At RenewCZ asks, here's mine. If you work on DLC's content, do you have to modify it depending on voice actor's unavailability?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, no,
that was a great answer.
Yeah, well, I do what I can. And I would say we have amazing voice actors, and we have an amazing VO department that do a great job. Like everyone, what's the right way to put this? There's no enemy. There is never anyone who is like trying to screw you over, like that mean principal who wants to see the class fail so that he can cancel the school dance. Like, there's no one who wants to not make things good. The voice actors, I believe they love doing this. The voice, the VO directors, they always want things to work. And at companies like this, where we have a lot of people in the cast, it usually relies on a ton of planning and knowing ahead of time, hey, by the way, if you want to get this person in a given piece of DLC, they're going to be off surfing in Fiji for the month of October. So have it done in September or be prepared to wait until November.
Makes sense.
Kind of stuff. It's not like we ever, we rarely have ever run into any kind of insurmountable obstacles. It's pretty much just, like I said, it's a box. It's here's the thing you get to work within. And, it's part of your job as a professional to find a way to make that work and make what you want to make out of it.
We do like having the voice cast back for party banter and such with the last piece of DLC. We thought that was awesome. So, thank you. Go ahead.
So next up, we've got Sarah McCharge at Archangel. And she says, I want to know Mass Effect the Musical. Is it panning out? That's future DLC, right?
Oh, no. And actually, to follow up that question, Testasis Mookie at Tasman said, the Palace Job, the musical, when can we expect that?
the great news on the Palace Job is I cannot be fired or worse, mocked for bringing up the idea.
All you have to do is look in a mirror and say approved, right?
Yeah, approved! I have gone on Twitter and said I would love to see the musical. I think a musical of Mass Effect would be hilarious. I would love to see singing Turians. I would love to see singing Solarians. more than I have already surreptitiously.
I was gonna say, wait a minute.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, these things happen.
Baritone Krogans.
Yeah, the key thing is doing it with respect to the IP. So, you know, the honest, sad answer is I doubt we would ever put out a game where Commander Shepard burst into song, which is sad because I think that would be freaking awesome. But I also can understand that I'm kind of a campy, goofy idiot. And that may not be what's actually right for Commander Shepard to do.
Well, I think if people remember on April Fool's Day, I think it was this year, that I believe it was BioWare that put out a video, like a cartoon of Shepard and specialists singing in a rock band. And it was so funny. So if any of you out there want to see Commander Shepard singing, then you can go watch that cartoon and Tally.
That was incredible.
Awesome. Oh, that's right. I can't remember what Tally played.
I don't remember, but I just remember laughing really, really, really hard. It was like Tally and guitars. I don't know.
I remember that, and I remember some awesome, it wasn't by us, but it was a fan mashup of I'll Make a Man Out of You to Mass Effect 2 characters. I remember Tally was Mulan. I can't remember who everybody else was, but it was beautiful.
So cool.
But yes, I'd love to see it. I think that would be a thing of beauty, and I think having those goofy bits of humor while probably not involving Commander Shepard ever, is one of those things that helps make the universe lovely.
So the next one, go ahead, Hillary. I keep cutting you off. I'm so sorry.
No. I jumped in there with Tasman's question, but I'll follow it up. So Bridget N. at Barbobot, and that's Bo spelled the French way. They should ask you, what's the coolest thing about unicorns? Ooh.
Oh, unicorns are awesome. They're sparkly. They're pretty. They represent purity.
They have cool names.
They're really, really shiny. They have awesome names that now that the book is in print, my wife cannot change.
So say it for me one more time, because I know that I butcher it.
Eululinia. As I have said, if you say it right, your tongue is making love to the rest of your mouth.
Whoa.
Eululinia. Just kind of work with that. Eululinia. You can't say that and not be sexy.
My face just got a tingly sensation. I don't know. This is strange. I can't stop saying it.
My wife has demanded repeatedly that the name be changed.
Scott Putt at Scott Putt or Putt 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 Putt, Putt says, "What is your favorite quote from ME3? What is your favorite quote?" I'm not reading this correctly.
No, Mass Effect 3 multiplayer.
What is your favorite quote, or I guess melee move from Mass Effect 3 multiplayer?
Multiplayer. It's got to be the Vorcha.
Yes.
Vorcha is the best character, and it's somewhere between me live when you get rezzed.
I'm alive.
Yeah. Or just the completely, like, no other character makes noise when they're just moving around, but yes. the slightly like the deviated septum asthmatic snarfling as he's just running around. I'm like, dude, I kind of love you. I love that you're saving the galaxy. I love that, like, you know, children on Eden Prime will owe their lives to you, Vorcha number 6.
Maybe it's that Vorcha thong that creates all of that speaking when he's trying to move
around.
I'm sure that's what it is, because that thing is, it's a little tight.
I think he's chafing, so he's just like, yeah.
To start a Kickstarter to get Vorcha pants so they can at least save the galaxy with some britches on.
Britches.
So we have a nerd appropriate signature question that we ask all of our guests, and we are excited to ask you the nerd appropriate signature question. And even though I feel like you've kind of already answered it, I do want to hear your answer. And the question is, what nerdy hobby or passion are you almost too embarrassed to share? So what do you collect? What do you like to do that no one else really knows about, or people will know after you tell us? But
So it's got to be. Because, yeah, I mean, going like, yeah, I totally play Dungeons & Dragons. That's like, well, you're on Nerd Appropriate, bro. That's
not really, yeah, kinda, yeah.
That's not really a thing at this point. Okay, well, I'd say Nerd Appropriate. Some of it's musicals, because we did talk a little bit on Twitter today.
Yes.
about about the manly pastime of musicals.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was deeply moved by seeing Les Mis as a teen. And
I was a teenager as well, and I actually really loved it.
And it is a badass musical, and that kind of my parents took me to a lot, actually, because we lived in Bay Area, California, and you know, we had easy access to San Francisco, and so I have occasional musical background depths that people will, you know, I'll say, you know what it should be. It should be like this thing from Into the Woods. And then everyone just kind of looks at me.
Oh, I love that show.
And it's like, wait, seriously? You couldn't go for The Hunt for Red October. You couldn't go for the Transformers movie. You're going to Into the Woods for your character reference? Yeah. Yeah, I am. Taker's wife is fucking baller, man.
That must be a Bay Area thing, because I'm the same way. And I feel like really? I saw a lot of musical theater. And I actually was in Theater Works in Palo Alto and just some other professional. Yeah, I did theater.
Just to clarify for you California folk, I lived in like a bog in South Florida and saw a whole lot of theater. So
yeah, good.
Okay,
I saw Man of La Mancha, Hillary, with Raul Julia. I saw the Raul Julia Man of La Mancha.
Was that San Jose Civic Light Opera, or do you remember?
I can't remember if it was. Yeah,
it was probably that. And then did you see Les Mis at De Anza, or did you see it at in San Fran?
I saw it in San Francisco.
Nice. And yeah, I saw it at De Anza.
And I think I saw it with Colm Wilkinson.
Oh, amazing!
Karen and I will fight over which Jean Valjean is the real Jean Valjean. I understand her Hugh Jackman thing, and I respect that. But but it's like it's all Colm Wilkinson for me.
Well, I'd say we've definitely unearthed a nerdy hobby or passion.
Okay, but seriously, no. Okay, but
it's not appropriate, guys.
Yeah,
but you look at Les Mis, this and it's got right. It's interesting because Les Mis has these elements that can appeal to a bunch of different people. Like depending on what stage of your life you're going through, you can always find someone to latch onto. Like you can go through your firebrand, like I'm going to change the world style and be like Enjolras or Marius. You can be, you know, you can be like I was in high school and alone and girlfriendless, and you can over-identify with Eponine, you know, singing sadly in the sewers. And then like, you know, getting older and stuff. And I'm like, okay, yeah, the Eponine storyline, like the music, you know, still totally moves me, but I'm not, you know, I now have a wife. Songs about being alone in the sewers don't really do it for me anymore. But the entire morality play of Jean Valjean and Javert has now taken on this whole new thing. So it's fascinating to see something like that just works on multiple levels and has different areas for people to have feels over.
No, I agree. I think there's something awesome about a good musical, and I don't. Yeah, unfortunately, you say that to you know a lot of people in the community. They're like, "What's wrong with you?" But it you know, I think it takes. If you see a handful of good musicals, you'll get it. You know, and there have been a few occasions in my life where I've had the opportunity to like you know see a couple things on Broadway, and it's always amazing. You know, and it's just a lot of talent. So,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
And you're excited about the movie, I'm sure.
Well, I'm an Anne Hathaway fan, so you know whatever.
Yeah, that's the thing. See, I was on the fence about Anne Hathaway, and I was like, really, seriously? And then just saw her. Okay, all right, never mind. Patrick was totally full of crap, not believing Anne Hathaway could pull off Fontaine. My bad. so once again, Anne Hathaway, you have proven me wrong. Anne Hathaway is Catwoman. Big mistake. Whoops. Okay,
so. She was good.
It was pretty good.
Well, that about does it. Thank you so much for coming on, and you know, you can come back anytime you want if you want to just like hang out and talk about games and you know play some Star Control, whatever you want to do. Whatever you want to do.
I assume some kind of Borderlands 2 multiplayer will happen.
We're all playing right now, I think, except for Hillary, who's about to play.
I am about to play.
Yeah, so we're all in. So we'll see you in there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. No, thanks for coming on. It was a blast having you, and we appreciate it so much. And let's go ahead and plug the book one last time.
Yeah, plug the book and let us know where we can get it.
Sure. It's called The Palace Job. It's by me, Patrick Weeks. It is available on Amazon and you can get it in book form, you can get it in Kindle form, and if you have e-reader formats other than Kindle, you can also get it from the Tyche Books website, and that's T-Y-C-H-E Books.
Awesome.
Or kind of pretty much any e-reader should be able to handle.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Patrick. Pleasure.
Okay, so thank you guys for listening to our nice long conversation with Mr. Patrick Weeks from BioWare and author of The Palace Job. And that was episode 75 of the Rated NA podcast. We actually have a couple contests now that we're going to share with you guys, and hopefully you get to win some stuff. So what do we got, guys?
So the first contest we have is actually geared toward the writers in the audience. So you'll see more about it online at nerdappropriate.com. But we want to know what your favorite thing about unicorns is. So just send us either a tweet at nerdappropriate or go to nerdappropriate.com and comment on the post that will be there. And just tell us a little bit about why you like unicorns. And we'll be picking the top few answers and then pulling them out of a hat. So,
and what do they win?
Many chances to win. So what they win, sorry. No, we just want you to do this for nothing.
Just tell us what you love unicorns.
We love unicorns. They're amazing.
It's a contest for us, you know.
Yeah, exactly. We're taking a survey. Just kidding. So the prize is, okay, do we have some kind of sound effect for drums? That would be fantastic.
Sure.
Yeah?
Sure.
Okay. So the prize is you get to have Patrick Weeks of BioWare fame, who wrote characters like Morden for Mass Effect. He will do a chapter critique for you. So if you're a writer or have something, you know, maybe about 4,000 words or so, if it's a short story, that winner will get a chapter critique from a very professional and amazing author. So there you go.
And for those of you who are like, oh, that's no big deal, that's a really big deal.
Really? Yeah.
You're having someone inside BioWare look at your work and form a dialogue with you. So that you should really want that.
Yes.
Yes, you should. So we're really, really grateful for to Patrick for doing this for us. And again, just send us a message either at nerdappropriate.com or tweeted us at nerdappropriate or even on Facebook. And just tell us what you like about unicorns. It's that easy.
And we'll put some more information out as we have it together for you for that one. And then the next one is super secret, guys. This is a secret podcast listener only contest. Here's the deal. We have two Kindle copies of his new book, The Palace Job, and we are going to give them away to you. And all you have to do is tweet to us anything you want to tweet to us. It can be the most ludicrous thing you feel like saying. We don't mind. If it makes us laugh, you know, we'll enjoy it all the more. And hashtag it LaunchFighters. That's all you got to do. It's that simple. Just tweet at us at NerdAppropriate. Hashtagged launch fighters, and we are going to pick two random winners, and you will win a copy of The Palace Job on the Kindle.
Could they do that on our Facebook page as well?
Yeah, I would assume you could if you can get to Facebook.
And if you want to give the secret away,
the secret,
because if it's sent to us, you know, pound launch fighters.
Yes,
you don't want people to see the secret.
Right. You don't want to decrease your chances.
There
of
you go.
Yes.
So there just tweet at us at NerdAppropriate, hashtagged LaunchFighters, and we are going to pick two people, and you're going to win a copy of the book. So that is good times.
Cool.
Yes.
Yay.
Well, thank you guys so much for tuning into episode 75 of the Rated NA podcast. We really enjoyed having Patrick on the show, and hopefully we have him back again in the future. And as always, you can find us at NerdAppropriate on Twitter, / NerdAppropriate on Facebook. Other places as well, I think.
Yes. You can email us, Matt, Ash, Scott, or Hillary with one L at nerdappropriate.com. And thanks for listening.
Here's to another 75, guys.
Yeah.
Woohoo!
Awesome. All right, Scott.
Oh, we didn't talk about Jimmy Henson.
We love you, Jimmy Henson.
Oh my goodness.